Vale.
I will say only positive things, yes. So.
Who does the translation?
It's
in another place.
We're not being videoed, are we? Or are we?
Are we recorded in video?
Well, on an iPhone.
The audio. And to speak, you can
press the button.
Yeah.
Doncs molt bon dia a tothom. És un plaer poder presentar un títol tan singular com aquest Akhnaten. Si fem una petita revisió del propi compositor, que fins als 42 anys havia estat taxista, soldador, lampista, peó de fàbrica, mosso d'alguna companyia de mudances, etc. Aquest perfecte antídot, no?, de la precarietat contra diguem, la realitat, la supervivència, però en l'anàlisi d'un aïllament d'un creador que en aquell moment havia de sobreviure, però que després se'ns ha presentat com un creador descomunal, com un geni en la composició, però després ja ocupa un lloc molt especial en tots els llibres d'història. Per tant, estem parlant d'un geni vivent que en dos anys, el gener del 27, farà 90 anys, que en el catàleg de les 25 òperes que ha escrit fins a la data fa una autèntica radiografia del nostre temps, des d'Einstein, Einstein, Gandhi, Galileu, Colom, Disney, entre d'altres, arribant a aquesta estrena estatal que ha hagut d'esperar des de l'any 1984 fins ara per ser estrenat aquest Akhnaten. En aquesta revisió de la figura d'un faraó en què imposa aquest monoteisme, amb aquest culte al sol, que interroga el poder de les idees radicals, que esdevenen llavors de transformacions absolutament històriques. No té una estructura narrativa, després segurament la mestra pot explicar-ho millor, sinó amb aquesta posada en escena, més la música i aquesta, no estructura narrativa, sinó més aviat ritual, no? Aquesta recreació d'aquest món espiritual amb una seqüència, diguem, de quadres simbòlics un darrere de l'altre. La força de la música per se ja és prou important, però no només, sinó que segurament la partitura necessita d'una posada en escena que il·lustri, que expliqui i que amplifiqui aquest missatge, fins i tot d'aquesta vocació que té la pròpia partitura en si mateix de convidar la comunitat a viure, a gaudir d'una cerimònia espiritual, gairebé que ens connecta amb els ritmes essencials de la vida, no? amb aquest caire gairebé hipnòtic que presenta la partitura. El Felix McDermott, en aquesta producció del 2016 de la English National Opera i Los Angeles Opera, és una referència absoluta. Crec que no hi ha millor posada en escena a l'actualitat que pugui explicar millor aquesta partitura, i segurament l'ajuda en aquesta visió gairebé epifànica de convidar els Gandini Youngling, no?, que dinamitza, subratlla, però amb aquesta estètica sumptuosa i visual, jo crec que estem davant d'un espectacle total, no?, que fa una referència absoluta a el que és l'òpera en gran. Per tant, sense més, jo sí que voldria convidar els meus companys de taula que expliquin, que puguin introduir una mica allò que tenim sobre el nostre escenari. Felim, welcome.
Gracias.
Okay. Do you want me to ask you some things?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So probably the first thing is how do you get to an ancient librettos playing so many things from the old past, trying to update it to today, right?
Push the button. Yes. Hello. I'm Felix McDermott. I'm the director of the piece. This is the second of Philip's portrait. Oh, actually, no, it's the third of that I did. So I did Satyagraha, which was about Gandhi, and then I did The Perfect American, which was in Madrid, which was about Walt Disney. And then I was asked if I wanted to do Akhnaten, and I got slightly worried that I was going to become a director who only ever did Philip Glass. So I was slightly reluctant, And then Tom Pye, the designer of the piece, said, "You have to do Akhenaten. It's amazing." And so I was re-listening, and I realised it was very important that we did do this piece. I actually first saw it in 1985 when it was premiered at the English National Opera, and there was lots of sand in that production. And at the English National Opera, they were getting sand out of the building for many years afterwards. So I knew it would not be sand. But we wanted to go, of course, back in time to this extraordinary period where Akhenaten, his 14-year reign, he created this time when it was a monotheism, the worship of the sun, a single god. And he himself, played by Anthony in our production, was the sun on earth, as it were. And it was very clear when I talked to Tom that we did not want it to look like a bad production of Aida because of ancient Egypt and how it can look cheesy. So we felt that it should be more like a dream of that time. It should be like a kind of strange world that you're drawn into, a dream, but also recognizing how we see ancient Egypt is often through, you know, in Britain, you know, the British Museum, this colonial prism through which it's seen. We didn't want to ignore that, so there's elements in the production that have that lens around it. So it's not an accurate portrayal of the time, historically. However, I feel that in the way that we've approached it, which is to treat the whole thing as a ritual, maybe even takes you closer to what the atmosphere of that time is like. So, Anthony, I don't know if you look like you were about to say something then.
Hi, I'm Anthony.
On.
Oh.
Right.
It was good. Hi, I'm Anthony, and I'm playing Akhenaten. Yeah, I mean, thinking back to the creation, you know, there is actually a narrative in the show, and that narrative is generated from these atmospheres in the music. And I feel that those of us in the show, you know, Zachary James, who plays Amenhotep III, and also the scribe and other people throughout, and is a force, you know, we sort of carry the story that we know in our heads energetically through the piece. What's amazing as we've taken this piece to different audiences is that they really perceive and project their own narrative onto it, which is very exciting. It's like a telepathic communication almost through the landscape of this music, which we create together. And we've seen that children love it, that first-time opera goers love it, even though it's an opera in ancient Egyptian without super titles translating every word, but rather it gives you a real sense of what it's like in ancient Egypt. I had the great pleasure of being a visiting fellow at Oxford in Egyptology, and the head of Egyptology said, "I've never seen a better portrayal of what ancient Egypt felt like than this." So as Phelim says, it incorporates all these different dream elements from, you know, the time of Howard Carter, the person who discovered Tutankhamun's tomb, until now. But it is a kind of ecstatic, and I would say almost a ritualistic or spiritual experience for those of us who perform it and have a communication with the audience.
Mm-hmm. And this first scene that happens in the show kind of became a key to the whole thing, because it's a recreation of a ritual from the Egyptian Book of the Dead. We don't really know what that was like. All we do know is that there was, in this ritual, there was the weighing of the pharaoh's heart against a feather, and they had to weigh the same amount. And if they didn't weigh the same amount, then Amenhotep III wouldn't get to go to the next realm. So we, through improvisation and atmospheres and working with the music, recreated this ritual, which I don't know, but I think it's quite close. But also the sense that we had in this ritual then goes through the whole show. And this discussion of, like, the narrative is interesting because, like in many of the portrait trilogies, Glass doesn't present these operas as, like, biopic, historical representations. It's more like he takes a moment and then he expands it, like, vertically rather than in a narrative linear way. So for me, they're like meditations on a key moment in the time of these characters. And that's what Philip's music does in an amazing way. It can take what would, and this happens in many operas, it can take a moment and suspend it and then really explore what's inside it. And I would say that sense of exploring it theatrically happens through our whole opera. So it's interesting for those who come and love the music and really get taken into this zone that you go into with Philip's music. In a sense, they go at the end, they go, oh, it's too short. They want it to continue because it takes them into this other state, and that's what's so beautiful about it. And I mean, there's some other things we might talk about later, but the juggling.
You want to add something about the Gandinis?
Yeah, so at the beginning, in these other operas, so in the opera about Gandhi, we'd explored materials, like humble materials, like newspaper, baskets, and how one might make, like, big, mythical, grand images with them. And then in the opera about Disney, we explored this vocabulary with the dancers, which was about animation and this repetitive thing that animators do, which fits with Philip's music. And I was like, what's the vocabulary for this opera? And I was floating in a flotation tank, as you do, for relaxation and meditation, which is, it's like a sarcophagus. You float in, it's got salt water in it, and you float on the top. And it's a good place to dream and to think and have ideas. And I got this image of juggling. And I thought, oh, that's really goes with Philip's music well. And then I thought, that's too crazy an idea. And then sometimes you get an intuitive feeling in your body where you go, no, this is so crazy an idea, it's probably maybe a good idea. And my wife, who's a circus performer, she said, oh, you need to talk to Sean Gandini, the juggler. So I rang up Sean and I had a conversation on the phone. And he said, you do know the first ever pictorial representation of juggling is an ancient Egyptian hieroglyphic. And there is a famous picture of women, and they're like in hieroglyphics, they're sideways on.
Like three balls.
Yeah, and they're juggling, and it's these very beautiful pictures. And of course, this for me was a synchronicity sign that that was a very good idea. So I then had to persuade the English National Opera that it was a good idea, but that there would be juggling all the way through the show. And Sean and his company do this incredible virtuosic choreography with their juggling. And for me, it's like a visual metaphor pattern of how Philip's music changes and shifts kaleidoscopically. So it becomes like a visual, like, metaphor, but a thing which makes you have a feeling in your body. And also it creates a kind of narrative tension in the piece, because it's used for things like the coronation, it's used for this ritual at the beginning, it's used for battle, and the juggling becomes like weapons. So it's become this beautiful vocabulary that goes through the whole show, and I feel like, looking back, I go, oh, we were quite brave to think of this as an idea. But now it's like, I can't imagine this piece. I know people do this piece elsewhere. But I can't imagine it without juggling, because it seems totally like the dream of what it should be.
Thank you, Philip. Maestro, how many times have you conducted the piece?
Is it? Okay. Good morning, everyone. Gosh, can we count? I think when I'm done with this, you guys will have done one production more. So I think 49 performances.
So you know it well.
I do. I do. And I always discover something new. So I will be doing another production of this in Paris. And I'm a little, I might need to talk to a therapist before I do it, because this, I mean, 9 years of my life with this show already, you know, and it becomes very much ingrained. And I've known Philip since I was 19 years old. So he's very much been a part of my life for most of my life. And this discovery that we've done together, the three of us, and then you came a little later, has been step by step. Discovery of what the music means to us, the pacing that we have, the commitment we have to it. We've become sort of a Philip Glass cult that people want to join, and that we incorporate new people into very quickly because of, first of all, Phelim's creativity and discipline and his method of working, then the Gandinis with their exact precision, and then with music that many people misinterpret as being simple. It's anything but simple. Philip's influence his whole life has been the culture of Indian classical music with ragas and talas and the rhythms, which require an immense amount of patience. And so he himself would say his music is an additive process, not a minimal process. So he takes one line, adds another one, and then the whole thing cycles subtly. And I love this process. I think it's cleansing. And I've heard this from the orchestra musicians. It's cleaning us up a little bit, because to do it properly, everyone, without exception, needs to focus on the purity of sound. And sometimes it's really difficult because there are very fast patterns where everybody's, you know, put their seatbelt on and holds on for dear life. But within that, there's an underlying calm and an underlying heartbeat that goes through the whole piece. And everyone on stage is absolutely committed to it.
What are the challenges for our orchestra to...
Stamina, intonation. Western classical musicians tend to steal time from phrases. Like in Mozart, you have a certain phrasing off. And then in Puccini, Verdi, you have a lot of rubato, rubare, and dare, give it back and steal it. Here, there's no stealing. You only give in the complete whole. So, and it's very, we can't play, without a click track, you can't play like a metronome, but we try to get as close as possible. And even if we shift a little bit, and we pull and push a little bit, it's still within the texture of being as steady as possible and as pure as possible. There's, you know, if you go to a rock concert, it's boom, ba-doom, 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 or techno, whatever, rave music, the beat just keeps going and going and going, and they dance to that. Fine. Here, if it's too much boom, 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 nobody likes it. So that has to be kind of subtle. And even within Attack and Fall, which is very, it's a war, it still has to be streamlined so that the public, their whatever, if you want to say chakras, their hearts, whatever, their minds, kind of open to it, and they become included in it, is my goal.
What is new in the orchestration here?
New is 1984. Yeah, there are no violins, so it's violas, cellos, and basses, and then the normal winds and percussion, normal brass and percussion. And so, with the exception of the flutes and some squeaky clarinets at the time, it's Anthony's voice that is kind of the treble clef. I mean, she sings lower than he does. Okay, Queen Tai is much higher, but you have this feeling that it's a really mellow sound, something very warm, something very grounded, something very earthy. And I think it's that. I love violins, so don't ever say that Karen doesn't like violins. But to have those overtones not be there for 3 hours is a very unique experience. You kind of go, ooh.
Good. Thank you.
I love violins, yes. For the record.
Anthony Rehab, do you want to say a few words about your experience here, about the piece?
Yeah, hello. My name is Rehab Shayeb, and very excited to be here and singing the role of Nefertiti. I think I love this because everybody kind of said their thing, and I'm like, okay, vocally, I think it's a very interesting piece because, yes, there are moments where Nefertiti sings much, much lower than Akhenaten. but they're most of the time they're just like almost there, you know, or like we sing at octaves where people, and I hear recording of us from last time and I'm like, who's singing what? There's this like unification of the roles, and that also shows us how Phelim was thinking about Nefertiti, the relationship of Nefertiti and Akhenaten. You know, we know that historically Akhenaten was very important, not only because he was the one of the first monotheists who created the one religion, but also he was the first pharaoh who put women at equal level as him. You know, and when you go, I had the pleasure of going to Egypt twice, and I even have some Egyptian blood as well. And you go there, and the era, because you have like a little pavilion, and the era of Akhenaten, it's, you see photos of the family eating together, you know, and all together, and you see in the old pharaohs that preceded him and the pharaohs that came after him, the pharaoh, the male, was always higher and the woman was below, and he was the first one who was put himself at equal level as her. But also it's super interesting because the statues that depicted Akhenaten were very feminine. He had hips like bigger than mine, hips and breasts, you know, where you're thinking, is he a woman or is he a man? And it's, I think that this thing where we're also exploring in this show, especially in act, in the further act, where you're like, oh, there, you'll see in the show when we get there, but there's like an under a layer of like nudity where you're like, who's the male, who's the female? Well, there's no really male or female. I think there's this vagueness to it, which I think is very beautiful, but also really exposes how he saw himself. He didn't see himself necessarily as a better person or as a man. I'm better than a woman.
That's my phone.
Sorry. It's an ad, isn't it?
It's the Muppets.
Minou, minou, pa, pa. Oh, there's an ad in Quebec. No, there is an ad in Montreal. Anyway, so there's that. There's also, you know, Anthony brought up the kind of meditation aspect of the show. When you go to Cairo, it's really weird because you're just driving and traffic is absolutely insane, and there's 5 lanes and there's actually a 6th lane because there's like a donkey in the middle, and it's crazy, right? And you're like, ah, and then all of a sudden you have these pyramids, and you suddenly stop and you're like, whew. And there's this weird thing where both time live together. Mm-hmm. Ancient time, oh, I have like goosebumps. Ancient time, eternity, and the present frantic, crazy time. And you really, I strongly suggest all of you to go and experience that, because there's, these people live their life and they almost don't care. They're like, oh, the pyramids. And we're like obsessed with it. We will make shows out of it, you know? There's this duality between the present, the past, eternity, and something as, you know, like as futile as traffic that you really feel over there. And I think we feel this in this show as well, because as you'll see, there's, you feel time. And how do you feel time is by seeing the difference in tempo in the music, but also tempo in our bodies. You know, I feel like the pharaohs, the family, all of us, Amenhotep, Nefertiti, Akhenaten, all these people who lived back then, we are in a very different bodily tempo as the jugglers, that to me represents a bit the present day, you know, the frantic traffic, social media, blah, blah, what's next, you know? And there's a really beautiful picture at the end where we all just stop and we cease to exist in eternity, but then you see the movement of time. Time always goes and washes away everything, and it's about how we get how we are remembered, if we are remembered. And finally, vocally and musically, I find, because you know, I was talking to Victor and I'm like, this is not necessarily my repertoire, you know. A lot of people ask me, why are you singing Philip Glass, you know? And I'm like, you cannot be a good singer and no sorry you cannot be a shitty singer and and sing Philip Glass. You need to have an extremely good technique, because for me, it's either the top passaggio or the lower passaggio, and it stays there the entire time. For I don't know for you, but it's just very demanding. And the first time I did, I went through this opera 3 years ago, I was like, oh my God, like, how do I do this to not get my larynx all the way up and, you know, breathe in a way that I'm not, you know, gasping. So it requires a tremendous amount of energy, focus, and technique. So people are like, oh, Philip Glass. I'm like, no, you cannot sing Philip Glass without a good technique, because it will focus you on your passaggio. It will focus you on your support. And actually, my technique got better after I sang Philip Glass, because there's no hiding. You can't hide behind a rubato. You can't hide, because the tempo is this, and that's where you are, and that's what you're doing, and you have to hold that. And Karen is very
precise. I'm going to butt in here, because I think you can, and people do sing Philip Glass without a good technique. It's the artistic choice that we've made as a team in how we want to do this musically. And yeah, I am like this, but you guys go for it. And then we raise our bar every day.
Yes, but that's the thing. I think vocally, it's so hard to sing this without a good technique. You know, you really need a complete understanding of your instrument to be able to respond to the demand of the show. And you know, just think about it, like walking so slowly and being able to lift your foot while singing and not doing this. We were talking about this the other day. It's everybody, you just lift your foot and you go. No, you have to lift. You never hold, actually. You're always breathing, but you're always breathing in a moment of sustainable support. It is incredible. I have learned so much. So,
something I want to say about, because it's so hard to talk about it with almost not making it sound like something else. One of the things that I've discovered about working with Philip's music in these operas is it's incredibly emotional, but it's not emotional in a sort of demonstrative way. It's an emotional in an invitational way. And if you create images which unfold and rhyme in the kind of correct sequence, you get, if you give in to that in the audience, you get these moments where you almost don't know why you're feeling the emotions that you feel. You get these kind of rushes. It's a bit like goosebumps, you know. I don't know why that's affecting me, but it's very powerful. So it's important to really recognize this incredible amount of technique, but we're using that technique to take people deeper and to take people into this other zone where these works speak. And as you say, they speak across time. Absolutely is an invitation to perceive time differently, to have an awareness of a longer period of time, because it is like when it works, it's like time travel. You know, it's time travel because 3 hours goes like that. It's time travel because it can take people back in time. And then there's also this other strange thing that happens whenever we do this show. There's always something in the news about a new discovery in ancient Egypt. This week, we were hearing about, they've just reopened Amenhotep's tomb after renovation work on it for 20 years. And we go, oh, yeah, they're doing something. There's always news about something being discovered. So we do feel connected to that time through the piece. And I feel like it's such a beautiful piece to do because, as Anthony was saying, it does also, like, across ages, people, you know, young people really love it. But it's also, it's kind of universal in a way. So,
and I'll just pick up on that and respond to one thing you asked, Victor, which is, how does it connect to our time today? Mm. And Akhenaten was a visionary in some ways. He, at 17... when he became pharaoh, had this idea. Where did it come from? That he would change the order of the world as it had existed, and he would change it from many gods to one god. He also changed how women were represented, how art was made, the language, where the cities were. He united Upper and Lower Egypt. He changed all of these things. The question I would ask you and the audience when you're watching this is Akhenaten good or bad? Was he a visionary and a progressive who changed culture? Or was he a cult leader who destroyed everything that existed in society? And this is a question that we ask, and I don't know if we answer it. Maybe we do and maybe we don't. But it's very interesting to think of Akhenaten as the first individual. He was totally unique, and that is why Philip Glass wrote this for a countertenor, because he wanted a sound that sounded unlike anything else when it came on, and with no violins, as Karen is saying, it comes out, and it is an individual sound. In addition, as Rehab was saying, there are these representations of Akhenaten that show him with what looks like breasts and big hips and lips. So people ask if he was intersex or if he was in some way, between or some other thing, or whether he made himself that way. So I would say, from our current perspective, the question I would ask is, was Akhenaten an important data point on the trajectory of the trans experience? He saw God as the sun, and the sun was between man and woman. It was neither a male god or a female god. And the pharaoh has to be closer to God than man, than the human. So did he in some way make himself, or was he himself between man and woman? So these are just some questions with everything that is happening in our world, with the leaders around our world, and trying to understand how we lead. It's interesting to look at this figure who, for his 13 or 14-year reign, changed Egypt, destroyed a lot of things, and then was himself destroyed by those around him, and everything he created was reversed and destroyed. What does that mean in our world? The other thing I'll say is, in terms of it being demanding, it's just fun to know that I enter completely naked, which is always terrifying for me. Phelim, in this transformation from vulnerable to royal to powerful, from man to woman, wanted to see the most vulnerable state. So not only do I enter naked, but we've waxed my entire body, every hair on my body, you can see. And so I enter in the most naked way possible. Of course, the Egyptians did a lot of waxing. For them, hair was evil. So,
and it helps Anthony sing higher.
No, exactly. It helps me get higher. And then there's a transformation, and the vocal part is some of the most Olympic demanding singing possible. In this presentation here at Liceo, there's one aria that is meant to be sung in the language of the audience. And when we have done it previously in London, in New York, in LA, we've done it in English. That is the language they speak. And that's because it's sort of in Akhenaten's mind as a kind of prayer. But here we do it in Catalan for the first time. So I'm really excited. There's a lot of sounds and vowels that I have to master to sound as understandable as possible. But it's a new, exciting, added challenge on top of all these others.
It's definitely a goosebump moment, I think. So beautiful.
Molt bé, si us sembla, obrim el torn de preguntes.
Sí, una pregunta per l'Anthony. Sí, una pregunta per l'Anthony és com ha transformat aquest personatge o ha influït aquest personatge a la seva carrera.
I think I'll start with the second part. I think Glass has changed my life and has changed me as a performer. It's changed the way that I can express who I am. Karen taught me that in all the other opera I sing, the expression happens in very small ways, in small phrases, in every word. Here, you have to express yourself over a duration, and the shift between the segments is the expression. So it is imposed a kind of discipline that actually results in freedom. And that's the great paradox. But also, obviously, this production has been a big success in other places, and so it has not only taught me how to perform better. Working with Phelim has certainly changed my life. We've been working together since 2011, I think, or 2009 if the workshop counts for that other piece. So, you know, he's taught me a lot, and the way that we perform this has influenced everything I do. How have I changed the character of Akhenaten? I will just say that in all performance, I think the human voice is kind of the deepest expression of who we are. And so what I feel I'm doing, in a way, is taking this mummy, unwrapping him, and through my voice and this team and these colleagues, making my own personal expression bring this era back to life. And we were saying, I think there's a lot of people now who never knew about Akhenaten before who know about him. And that, for us, is very exciting. And I think we've all become Egyptologists in some way. Zachary James can show you his tattoo of a hieroglyph from Akhenaten. So.
I otra cosa volia saber, fins a quin punt el moviment precisament dels artistes d'escena té que veure amb els jeroglífics, no? O sigui, això que explicaven ells d'anar acompassats amb el temps i controlar els moviments d'alguna manera, no? No moure's com normal, ve d'aquí també, no?
In Tom's design, one of the first things we did was we created this set with the three levels. So even that is an invitation to kind of remember these things. So we're seeing these different levels and the different rhythms on each level. So on the top we have the first theme of the jugglers, and then we have the chorus, and then underneath we have the royal ritual. So you can't avoid that vocabulary, but we never said let's look like hieroglyphs. And the movement is always constantly changing. So it's almost like if you recreate the sense of a hieroglyphic shape or the form of it, you're passing through it. So you have a moment, and then... So for me, the way that we're working on stage with the slow movement is so that people can dream into what they see. Rather, it's why I say we're not trying to be accurate. You're trying to evoke people's dreams of what ancient Egypt is. You know, I talked about, in the early rehearsals, I talked about being a young boy and reading about the opening of Tutankhamun's tomb. And it was such an atmospheric thing. And I had a little education pack where you could build a little sarcophagus. And it had all these newspaper cuttings. And there's the story of when the tomb was first opened and the air rushed in. And there was this moment where they, for a second, they saw all these feathers. And then as the air rushed in, the feathers fell. And... I'm touched by it, because these things have been there for years and years, thousands of years, and then they're gone, and that's such a beautiful atmospheric story. So I wanted the show to feel a bit like the atmosphere of that moment. So I don't know if I'm answering your question, but we didn't ignore that iconography, because it's there, and sometimes we visit it beautifully, but also it's mixed in with, like, Victorian, you know, kind of imagery, and some of the ritual almost looks like a British, like the crowning of the of our own, you know, queen. You know, we didn't do that consciously. It's almost like afterwards I thought, oh, that costume, and then some other things happened when we did it in New York. The you know the famous fountains outside the Met Opera, that had a moment where I said, oh, look, the balls going up look like that. So there are dreams in these. There are dreams in these images. And if you perform it in the correct way, people will have dreams and echoes I couldn't even begin to imagine. So people will see moments that do look like that. But most of all, I want them to feel like they saw things we didn't even put in there. Does that make sense?
I think they're going to see some Gaudi in the show as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Are we going to see it together
or
just by chance?
By dream, by the dream. You know, there's many, many opportunities to see dreams. And watching the opera, if you surrender to the way the music invites you, you have a simultaneous experience. You'll see the pictures, you'll hear the music, but there'll be another layer, which is what theatre can do that film does not do so well. This is why theatre and opera is better. This is because there's another layer, a dreaming layer, where we are also dreaming images and dream images as we watch. So good shows, we know this happens. And you see things that, you know, only are personal to you because they're your dreams. Opera can do this better than anything.
The question was about also when you recreate this, maybe people didn't get this imaginary of Dune with Chalamet, Dune with this, what you know, the grounded things that boom, 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 boom in the ground. And now is a new world after that. Mm-hmm. So did you ever think about that? About
do you mean the
movies? Yeah.
Yeah, the sci-fi books.
Yes.
You know, in a way, if you think, as I read those books as a kid, you know, and again, they're very evocative and beautiful, so it's like a dream of an alternative universe. And I would say we probably created our own. He was obviously influenced by those other cultures. So I think...
North Africa.
Yeah, exactly. So I think we're kind of... You know, I watched those films and I went, they're operatic, you know, they're operatic. So good art borrows from each other, you know. So absolutely, I think. But we did ours first.
I also wanted to know, Karen, how was, when you were 19, the meeting with Philip Glass and, yeah.
So I was assisting his best friend, who is still one of his best friends, Dennis Russell Davies. And I might have met him when I was 20, but I learned his music when I was 19, 18, 17, when I saw the, in 1989, saw the film Pawakatsi. And I went, oh my God, I need to know this music. And then I found everything about him. And when I asked a professor where I could go in Europe in the summer to assist someone with opera, he said, call Dennis Russell Davies. And so, like, I went in the summer, and I think 2 weeks after that, I met Philip. And I played with the ensemble in New York one time for a concert when the Low Symphony came out. And then Philip, we had a great rapport with each other. I had a little dog at the time, and he would always sit with Philip. And there's someone did a sketch, I have to find it, a sketch of me sitting on the podium and my little dog between us. And so we've always had this warm rapport, but it just came because I researched. And what was the destiny, the fate, was meeting this other conductor who happened to be, like, I couldn't have planned it. Like, and he stayed in my life since then.
You know, the wonderful thing about Philip is he's such an extraordinary, warm person. And when I first did the first opera, Satyagraha, he said, I don't care what you do with it. You can do whatever you want. He's never prescriptive about how you solve the dramatic challenges. His only insistence was that we did the whole opera and we didn't shorten it. so he wasn't in the room at all in that way, mm-hmm. but he's a fantastic collaborator because he knows if his operas are going to continue, there will be many, many productions of them, like there are, yeah. And that's, he's totally open to that. So not like some composers who are still alive. They're very prescriptive. He's very open, and he's such a warm person.
Yes, he's extremely warm and extremely loving, and he was angry at me for a good 10 years.
Oh, okay.
He was, because the first 10 years of my career, I did so much Philip Glass. And at the time, as a female conductor 25 years ago, it was not the same scenario that it is now with the opportunities for women. And all I was doing was Philip Glass. I was recording. I was doing stuff off-Broadway with him. I was traveling on tour for a year with them. And no one was hiring me for anything else. And then he asked me, you know how the business is, he asked me to do... The Truman Show. And it conflicted with a bohème that I wanted to do for the New York City Opera. And I did say, Philip, I said, gosh, I'm so honored, but I have to take this bohème. And then there was radio silence for 10 years until my brother, who I don't really talk to anymore, wrote to Philip and said, my sister's in Austria now and you're on tour and, you know, you should get together. And so I went and saw, it was, I think, Dracula on tour or Belle et la Bête, one of those others. And we met up and he said, ah, you're back. But I came back to his music because I did, in Freiburg, we did some stuff when I was chief conductor there. And in Hanover, we did stuff. And I've been doing it all along. But I came back, and I think he appreciates now, with a wealth of instrumental knowledge that I did not have when I was. So I could have been playing it like a new music person, which is a totally different take. And when I work with the instrumentalists here and I'm sculpting this sound, it's with this knowledge of the traditional repertory that I can use techniques that they understand to get where I want to go. And I think Philip has seen this, and so he forgave me. I forgave him.
So maybe Anthony and Rehab Cannon also tells us how was, I mean, Philip said something to you? Is any kind of advice or just you ask for something?
Like Karen said, I'm a pretty new addition to the team and the family, and, you know, if you want to say the cult of Philip Glass. And I've met him once when he came to our opening at the Met. And you can feel like he's loved by everyone in New York, on stage, in the pit. There's a lot of admiration that we all have for him. And it was really, I mean, it was a pillar of my time in New York to meet him. But yeah, I'm pretty new. I've done also some of his opera, like Satyagraha in Europe a few years back, but I'm the last addition. So it was very nice to meet him, but I don't know him as much as my colleagues, unfortunately.
When we were in LA, I remember there was a knock on my door and Philip Glass came in and he said, hi. And I said, hi, I'm so glad you're here. And it's so good to see you. And he said, yeah, I just have a question. And I said, okay. And he said, do you have to rehearse this a lot? And I said, yeah, it's really hard to remember, you know, how many times you say, and, you know, all of the things. And he said, oh, I'm so glad to hear that because I'm playing some of my own music this weekend. I just find I have to rehearse so much. It's really hard. And I said, yeah, it is, Philip. Why'd you write it like that? So he's, you know, he's so funny and so nice. And as Phelim says, I think what's extraordinary is there's almost no other composer who is so respected in the classical world amongst the highest level of every institution, and also has their music in video games, in films, in commercials. And it's not because he is any less careful or any less, in fact, he is more of a craftsman and an artist, but it is because he allows people to interpret his music in their way. And he chooses collaborators like Phelim and like Karen, who he knows will take care of it and make sure that there's some control over that. But once he chooses them and trusts them, he trusts them with it, and he doesn't micromanage it. And that has allowed his music to become universal. There are many imitators, but I think that when you hear the real Philip Glass, there is a total distinction to that music, and it takes you to a very special place.
There is also, Zachary James is here, also a close collaborator with Philip Glass, and we in the spring are doing a world premiere of Philip Glass's 15th Symphony, which very well might be the last piece that will be presented to the public in his lifetime. And it's based on another iconic figure, Abraham Lincoln, which he always wanted to write a piece about. So the symphony is called Lincoln. It's being performed at the Kennedy Center, which does not come without complications. So keep your eyes and ears open for us in the spring, in June.
I'm very curious about how could you, Anthony, thought that making wax for everyone from a Liceo and showing the, you know, hair and whatever could be a good taste thing to do as a commercial of this opera?
Well, I think it's, you know, opera is so confined to one particular vision of what it is and who the singers must be. And, you know, I also run an opera company. I'm the general director of Opera Philadelphia in America. And what I see as a trend is that the audience is getting smaller and smaller. And as we try and serve that audience, we serve them what we think they want, which is red velvet and gold leaf. And that is a big part of what we do. We love it. We have lots of gold leaf on our bodies. But if we want to interest a new audience, we have to represent this art form in all different ways. The reality is there is something extraordinary about me and Zachary James going and getting waxed for this show. And something silly and something ridiculous. And to know that that is a part of opera, to know that the young people around the world who have come to see this show, who are devoted, I encourage you, go look at the comments on the post that we made yesterday, and you will see hundreds of people who have said, I loved this at the Met. It was my favorite show. I'm so glad you're doing it. I loved this in LA. I saw it in London 3 times. You will see that people, young people, respond to it. And the question I ask is it bad taste, or is it a way to get in this crazy social media universe that we live in, people's attention that the Liceu is all of a sudden posting a strip of wax. So I hope it doesn't offend anybody. This is not my goal at all. My goal is, yes, we have a performance on the 16th, which is sold out, of all people under 35. But that shouldn't be the only performance that people under 35 come to. We hope that they come on that show and they want to come back, or that they hear about it from their friend who went to that show and they say, I must come. And when they go and they see this video, they see someone who is closer to them and not someone who feels distant or elite or far away. How do we make it feel of us?
Go ahead.
Sorry, I just want to kind of continue up on what Anthony was saying. It's what's, of course, there's the waxing, and that's one area of it. But what I've seen last time I've done it is a lot of actual Egyptian people who, you know, for most people, they don't know who Akhenaton is. But Egyptian and a lot of the Middle Eastern, they know because it's part of history. It's part of their history. And what I've seen last time we've done it, it was a lot of Egyptian writing me being like, oh my God, like, because besides Aida, you know, so this is the first time we hear about just another pharaoh. So for them, it's a different demographic that, yeah, let's be honest, doesn't actually go to the opera. So this is also, besides the waxing, it's another demographic that we're interested in, you know, people who are being, you know, what am I trying to say here? Or being like, you know, they're going to see this because, yeah, they're being seen, and it's their history, it's their culture. So there's, I think this show has touched a lot of different people as well.
In terms of youth, there was, when we did the broadcast, they didn't allow him to be naked. So, but my best friend who has four kids, the youngest, the oldest at the time being 15 and the youngest being 9, she brought them all to the show. It was their first opera ever in New York. And one of the kids plays trumpet, and the trumpet plays a really important role in this piece. It's kind of the secondary voice of Akhenaten. And the kid went home, and he was playing everything by memory that he had heard from the piece. They didn't even notice the nudity. It wasn't like, oh, I told her about it, but they didn't notice. It's so beautifully done that my mother, who saw it twice in New York, when she saw it in the cinema, she was like, why did they do that? And my mother doesn't like nudity in film at all. So it's so artistically done. And then the kid who was playing the trumpet, the next night was when they used that clip in the TV series Stranger Things. And he said, Mom, Auntie Karen's on the TV, Auntie Karen's on the TV. And she was like, no, that's not Akhenaten. No, it's not. And she said, yeah. He said, yes, it's Anthony's voice, and it's all of that. It's Auntie Karen. And she called me. She said, are you on TV? And I'm like, I am. And so that's how it affects the kids. Like, they make it, especially if you bring children, bring all the children to the opera, and they know you personally, like, it just, the chain goes further and further, because opera is nothing to be afraid of at all.
I'll just add that when we did it in New York, there was one 2.5-year-old, the daughter of the assistant director. And so she came to see the show, the dress rehearsal. And I, for years, got video. She never forgot it. And she acted out every scene. She got juggling balls and would walk. She carried her doll the way that Zachary James carries me. You know, she acted out every part. It had such an impact. And I thought about, why is it? And it's this thing of Phelim saying there's a dream sense to it. Also, when you are freed from the normal experience of opera, where you're reading, trying to get the translation going, when you just watch, your mind is allowed to see these pictures, and you feel like a child. And the children who play dress up and who play that they're a king or a queen or a knight or whatever they are, they see all of these stories in the show, and it has such an impact on them. So it's wonderful to see that.
What Phelim said about putting some iconography of Victorian. Because, well, maybe Victorian has something from Egypt. I mean, this is something that came all along. Have you studied that?
No, I mean, not specifically. So when we were first making this, I was living in a place called Twickenham. And if you go around Twickenham, there's bridges, and they have pyramids in them, and then they have these brass. So they had a kind of fetishism about ancient Egypt. So I was like, I said, we should not ignore that. So it's sort of, you'll see in the show, there are like, some of the costumes, they look like ancient Egypt, but they also look like, you know, someone's got an umbrella and someone. So it is like a fever dream of these moments in time mixing up. And how we experience, you know, we experience ancient Egypt through, if you're lucky, you get to go there and you go, whoa. But I experienced it through the lens of the people who taught me what it was. So that's, we can't ignore that. So that's kind of in the production as well, I would say. Is that, you understand? So it's through the lens of appropriation. You know, colonialism, appropriating a fetishistic idea of what that, oh, this exotic thing. So I would also say that's in our dream and not ignored.
May I ask, what are we
going to
see? In the scenario? What is the staging?
there's the story of Akhenaten's.
You'll see, as Phelim said, these three levels that represent the hieroglyphs. There are different chambers. There's a chair, there's a mummy, there's a throne. And then at some point, it breaks open and there's this incredible three-dimensional huge sun that takes over the scene. And elements from all of these different things that we see, there's a frame that is the window of appearances, which is referenced in the libretto, and you'll see this descend. You'll see a shift from a kind of egg-shaped iconography into a sphere-shaped iconography. So you'll see all of these different shapes and incredible kind of expressive gestures from Tom Pye, the set designer. And the textures are also really incredible. You can't always decipher what they are, but with Bruno Poet's lighting, you see the contours of all of these things, and something you might think is transparent becomes hard, and you see lots of different representations of the sun with interesting lighting tricks.
Mama ball. So there's this huge sun. It's the huge ball. And the first time Sean Gandini and the jugglers saw it, they juggle huge balls. I'm not going to say much more than that. But Sean Gandini, it's a joke. Now he's like, oh, that's the mama ball. And so you see them all juggling in front of the sun, and they're like praising the sun. Mm-hmm. It's amazing.
And how many instruments?
I guess we're about 45, 46 in the pit. So double winds. We have some, like, in the brass and the trumpets and the horns, because the parts are very exposed and very difficult. They have what we call bumpers, so assistants to help them cycle through. Because the way it's written, for the woodwinds, they alternate. There are many places, a few places, where I ask them to all play at all times. But it's written in a way, unless you can circular breathe, like the Philip Glass Ensemble does, but classical musicians generally do not. They have to alternate, so they just don't die on the spot. And I've just told the strings, because if you're going for 5 minutes, it's repetitive. Yeah, it hurts. So they also take a little time off, and they shake it out. So it's about 45, 47 people.
You know...
No. He's 75% sold.
What's that?
75% sold. So
of the whole.
Potser com a recomanació final. O sigui, l'any 92 es va presentar a Einstein on the Beach, aquest teatre. Va ser una enorme proesa pel teatre, pel públic. Això té uns paràmetres diferents. És més un espectacle molt visual, molt atractiu des de molts fronts de vista. Allò era un exercici realment molt intel·lectual també en aquella posada en escena, no? I jo crec que una part del públic la va viure amb un punt de trauma, si es pot dir així, però el xoc en la potència del missatge de Philip Glass en aquell primer experiment d'Einstein on the Beach, jo crec que continua sent molt, molt vigent i molt extraordinari. Això ja es configura d'una altra manera, amb una òptica molt, molt diferent. Ho dic pel contrast, perquè no ens quedem amb el Philip Glass d'Einstein on the Beach, en el que va significar, també. Moltes gràcies i bon dia.
Thank you for the translation.
Very good, yes.
And if we can do one photo fast in the mirror hall,